Hey, good morning, everybody, and welcome to class. This is the last class before spring break. It is March 25th, and we're going to finish up central nervous system and move into peripheral nervous system today. So I'm going to turn some of these lights down, like that one and that one. I think that's great. All right, does anybody have any questions from last time? Central nervous system can be confusing, so I'll go over to that pre-lecture reading assignment, read the chapter. All right, so we got spring break coming up next week. Today's the 25th, so when is the next exam? Next exam is on a Monday, April 20th. So when is that? So that's two and a half weeks from today. And the Monday classes that have lab, or the Monday labs, will have a practicum on that day as well as the lecture exam. Don't get fooled by that one. Don't get caught short of time. So it's chapters 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. And we're going to get into chapter 14 today. So those are the chapters for the lecture. And then in lab, listen to what's going to be on the third practicum. Probably 7, 8, and maybe 9, I'm not sure. Something like that. All right, April 20th, that's the schedule. Anybody got a question on that schedule? No? Sounds good. All right, well, yeah, sorry. I'll turn the lights up so I can see you.
Do we have
I'm sorry. I gotta deal with this door right here because I can't quite hear you with the noise out here. Okay, what was that question? No, it's a free week. Okay, so the next one will be the Thursday, right? Yours are on Thursday night every Thursday. Will be Thursday after spring break. So spring break really is time off. But all those modules will be there if you want to do it. And of course, it's always a good thing to get 1 week ahead anyway, because then you'll never miss an assignment. Some of my classes, students are beginning to miss assignments, so don't forget about that Thursday night at 11 deadline. Not all the modules are open, but at least for the third exam, they are open, right? So just take care of that. Well, we were in the cerebrum when we left off last time, and we're going to stay in the cerebrum for a little bit. Does anybody remember what white matter in the central nervous system is called? White matter in the central nervous system. White matter in central nervous system. Nobody remembers? Uh-oh. Okay, white matter, is it, it's going to be a part of a neuron. What part of the neuron? Yeah, it's going to be myelinated because it's white. And what gets myelinated, dendrites or axons? Axons, all right. So it's myelinated axons going someplace in the central nervous system. What the heck is that called? That's called a tract. That's right. Remember, myelinated axons in the peripheral nervous system, we're just going to call those nerves. They're going to be similar to tracts, but a little bit different. All right, so I want to look at some tracts that are in the central nervous system, and we're going to classify them by what they do and where they go. And here is a really good slide that shows that. So here's an illustration on the left-hand part of the slide. Here is a picture. And if we just look at the picture very casually, do you see that there are areas that are dark and areas that are light colored? That should be obvious. The lightly colored areas is white matter, and the darker areas are what we call gray matter. Right? So all of this white matter right here are tracts that are going someplace. And then here we have nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the gray matter. Gray matter is right on the surface of the brain and also deep inside the brain. So here we see some gray matter deep inside the brain. What are we going to call these? Really important for control of movement and motion. These are the basal nuclei. Basal nuclei. Your book misnames them. Your book calls it the basal ganglia. That's a much older kind of designation. But remember, gray matter inside the central nervous system is a nucleus, not a ganglion. Where do you find a ganglion? Anybody remember? In the, peripheral nervous system, right? Almost the same kind of stuff, right? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites, but in the peripheral nervous system. All right, so I see white matter. These are tracts. notice that this right here is the parietal lobe and and there is a big depression between the right and left cerebral hemispheres. We call that the longitudinal fissure. Right, the longitudinal fissure goes all the way from anterior to posterior. I suppose they could have called it the sagittal suture or mid-sagittal, but they did. They call this the longitudinal fissure. And so the right and left sides of the brain really don't communicate with each other very well because there's this big space between them, except for a couple structures. Right, and so here we see something we call the corpus callosum. And maybe it's labeled on the slide, I'm not really sure, but can you tell me the corpus callosum, is it gray matter or white matter? It's white matter, which is what? Axons that are going someplace. And this is one place in the brain where the right side and the left side of the brain can communicate with each other. So there are axons going both ways through the corpus callosum. And then here I see it on the illustration. Can you see these fibers going right to left from one cerebral hemisphere to the other, from the right to the left cerebral hemisphere, or from the left to the right cerebral hemisphere? These are what we call commissural fibers. And in particular, we're looking at the corpus callosum. That's always going to be a nice landmark for everybody to find. All right, so that's one type of fiber. Right? These are commissural. Commissural fibers always take information via myelinated axons from the right hemisphere to the left hemisphere or from right to left, any place in the central nervous system. All right, we have another kind of tract that I see right here, and notice these are, I can see them inferiorly and they move all the way superiorly. And I see some over here on the side over here. Okay, and these kind of fibers we're going to call projection fibers. So projection fibers take information from a superior region to an inferior region in the central nervous system, or the other way around, right? From inferior to superior. It just so happens that these right here that I notice, right? This white matter between the basal nuclei, this is what we call the internal capsule. And this is very important for motor signals leaving the cerebral cortex to get down to the spinal cord, internal capsule. So this is like a super highway for motor information, internal capsule. And furthermore, you should know that these are projection fibers, right? So far we talked about ones that go from right to left, those are commissural, top to bottom or bottom to top, those are projection. And then there's one last kind. There is a kind that stays within one hemisphere of the brain that I see right here. They go from one gyrus to another gyrus, so they share information between the different gyri that are on the same side of the brain, and we call these association fibers. So they don't go up and down, they don't go right to left, they just go from one gyrus to a neighboring gyrus, or maybe skip a couple but stay on the same side of the brain. Association fibers. All right, so those are the three main kinds of white matter in the cerebrum. And you're going to know something about these projection fibers, right? And you got to know something about these commissural fibers because they make up the corpus callosum. And if that corpus callosum ever gets damaged, then the right side of a person's brain won't know what the left side is thinking. And that produces really strange kind of effects. Right, because we have different abilities on different sides of our brain. For instance, we might be able to recognize numbers on one side of our brain, like a 2 and a 3, and somebody could ask us, well, what do you see? And a person will just clearly say, well, I see a number 2 and a number 3. And then the next question would be, well, what if you add those two numbers, what do you get? And the person is stumped because those numbers can't get transferred to the other side of the brain where the mathematical ability is. All right, so that sounds really strange. So really strange things like that can happen to people because functional centers can be on opposite sides of the brain. And what kind of tracts do we need, or what kind of fibers do we need so that the right side of the brain can talk to the left side or share information? Yeah, commissural fibers. And the major region for that is what we call the corpus callosum. Okay. So cerebellum, I see a little bit of cerebellum poking out posteriorly here and here. It has something that almost looks like gyri, but they're very, very small. And so the cerebellum gets information from one part of the brain stem. Anybody remember where the cerebellum gets information from, what part of the brainstem. Let me show you this right here. Here is a nice picture of a cross-section, sagittal section of the cerebellum. It's right on the other side, opposite side. It is the pons. Right, so the pons is a relay station for information getting into the cerebellum. And it's the job of the cerebellum to maintain posture and balance when your body is moving around and coordination. And so it can make fine adjustments to your skeletal muscle motion. Right, so not all the time do you move exactly perfectly. Sometimes you're going to reach out and grab an object, or you're going to lift an object up, and the object is heavier than you might imagine, and so it's the job of the cerebellum to keep balance everywhere in the body, but also get enough muscle fiber so that you can lift that object if it's not too absolutely heavy. Or if you trip on the sidewalk, right? It's the job of the cerebellum to help you maintain equilibrium so that you don't fall down. So it's involved with coordinating muscle activity, which is motion of the skeletal system. Okay. All right, well, that takes us into the spinal cord. So where is the spinal cord located? Well, it is inferior to the brain. And let's see if I can find a nice picture. Ah, here's a great picture. All right, so here is the brain. And here is the spinal cord. Spinal cord, of course, is still the central nervous system. And where's that line of demarcation between brain and spinal cord? What separates brain from spinal cord? What region would you look at? What structure would you try to find? Okay, it's really easy once I tell you. It is the foramen magnum. Does that ring a bell, foramen magnum? Sure, right? That's just a big hole in the occipital bone. Everything above the foramen magnum is considered brain. Everything inferior to the foramen magnum is considered spinal cord. So here we see spinal cord. And of course, you know the areas of the spinal cord, the divisions, right? We got cervical region, thoracic, and lumbar region. And we've named vertebrae after those regions. Right? So here is a thoracic region. And what makes this region special? How do we know this is thoracic region? It's not shown on this slide, but there's something special in this region. What is special that makes it thoracic? Yeah, it's got to have ribs, right? So if there are ribs attached to these vertebrae, then it is a thoracic vertebrae. All right, you notice that there is a swelling of the spinal cord in the cervical region, right? And there's also swelling down here in the lumbar region. And not so much in the thoracic. It gets kind of narrow in the thoracic region. All right, what do you have in coming out of this part of your body and also down over here, which might require more innervation, more coordination, more reflexes? Okay. I didn't quite hear anybody's thoughts. Ah, yeah, so this cervical region, this cervical enlargement is there because we have two upper appendages, right? And there's all kinds of reflex activity and coordination that takes place in the upper appendage. And then for this lumbar enlargement, you have your lower appendages, right? And it requires more interconnections, more association neurons to coordinate reflexes in that area. All right, here is the tip of the spinal cord. And right at the tip of the spinal cord kind of tapers into a point, kind of like an ice cream cone right here, and it's called the conus medullaris. And the spinal cord doesn't go down all the way down to the sacral region because our bones grow faster than our nerves can. And so the spinal cord stops growing at about the level of L2, lumbar 2. And then nerves leave the spinal cord, stay in the vertebral canal, and exit through the intervertebral foramina or the sacral foramina. So in this region, you have nerves and not spinal cord. So what do we call the tip of the spinal cord? The conus medullaris. And where would you find that on somebody? About what level of the vertebral column? L2 it stops. That's right. Okay, so there is cerebral spinal fluid that helps support the brain, and there's cerebral spinal fluid as well that floats around the spinal cord. And sometimes there's an infection in that cerebral spinal fluid, and we need to look at it, okay? Or maybe hemorrhage, right? That cerebral spinal fluid should be clear all the time. It shouldn't be red. That would be a sign of maybe a bleeding someplace in the brain or inflammation, right? And of course there shouldn't be bacteria, viruses, or fungi, so sometimes we need to remove some of that cerebral spinal fluid and analyze what's in there. Does anybody know what that procedure is called? Yeah, it's commonly called a spinal tap. So where would you want to insert a needle to get some of that cerebral spinal fluid? Would you like to insert that needle into somebody's brain? No. What about between C1 and L2 if you insert a needle? No, because you might lacerate part of the spinal cord and then that part will never heal, right? Because spinal cord injuries never heal themselves. And that's going to produce some kind of deficit. So you would try to remove some of that cerebral spinal fluid from below L2, where that spinal tap needle is placed. Then the syringe is aspirated, and that removes some cerebral spinal fluid for analysis. Right? So that's the importance of knowing where that spinal cord ends. All right, well, since the spinal cord ends right here, there's a lot of space down below it. There's not much really holding the spinal cord in place. Right, so it could retract all the way up, right, to the cervical region or thoracic region, and that would produce some really nasty deficits as well. So there is something that acts very much like a ligament that keeps the spinal cord in the correct position, and that is called the phylum terminale. Phylum terminale is this thing right smack in the center, and that helps anchor the spinal cord or the coronis medullaris to the coccyx or parts of the sacrum. Right, and so that just keeps the length of the spinal cord correct. And in some people, unfortunately, this phylum terminale doesn't extend, doesn't grow, does not elongate. So as they're developing, right, the conus medullaris is attached to the coccyx here. And the spinal cord was never designed for that to happen. And it gets stretched and stretched and stretched and damaged when that happens. And so that should be diagnosed hopefully early on. And that adhesion released, right, so that spinal cord should go back up to its normal location. That condition is called a tethered cord, right? So that's how important that phylum terminale is, right? Keeps the spinal cord in the right spot. And if the conus medullaris adheres to a lower region, that causes big problems. That's what we call a tethered cord. All right, well, below L2, I still see some stuff. In here, these are nerves. That's no longer spinal cord, but these are nerves that come from different levels of the spinal cord. And there are a number of them, and they all are side by side. And it reminded somebody of a tail on a horse that has a lot of horse hair coming out. And so that region of the vertebral canal that contains all of these nerves and that spinal cord, that is what we call the cauda equina. What structure do we have right in the middle of the cauda equina? What structure is that? There's a structure right smack in the middle. The phylum terminale is right there. That's right. That's not a nerve, right? That's connective tissue stabilizing the position of the spinal cord. Okay. So do you have any conus medullaris? No, I'm sorry. Do you have any cauda equina superior to the conus medullaris? No. Where would you have it? Inferior to the conus medullaris, right? Which is the endpoint of the spinal cord. So the spinal cord, what's the extent of the spinal cord? From foramen magnum all the way down to L2. That's where we know where the spinal cord exists. Okay. So I think I have some good notes for you to see there. Now what else do we know about the spinal cord? I think we need to now look at a cross-section of the spinal cord. Now what kinds of matter do you remember in the central nervous system? Yeah, white and gray. So here is a nice cross-section of a spinal cord, and I can see some other membranes around them. And when you look at the spinal cord, you see areas that are dark and areas that are light. Yeah, so I see white matter that is superficial and gray matter, which is deep. This is sort of a different arrangement compared to the cerebrum. Remember, cerebrum, gray matter was superficial, white matter was deeper. Not so for the spinal cord. And let's consider this white matter for a second. What do we know white matter is made up of? Myelinated axons going someplace. Exactly right. So in this part of the spinal cord, we have tracts, right? Because it's central nervous system. And some of these tracts are going up to the brain, bringing sensory information in. Some of the tracts are descending, taking information to effector organs. right, in the periphery of your body. So some tracts are what we call sensory or afferent if they are bringing information to the brain, right? They're motor or efferent tracts if they're taking information away from the brain. They're descending. The information is descending. And the arrangement of these tracts sort of follows the architecture of the brain. So remember, what is the lobe of the brain that is most anterior? Frontal lobe, yeah, nice. And what is the lobe of the brain that is just posterior to the frontal lobe? Parietal. Yeah, so let's consider frontal and parietal lobes. One is known, right, to contain or to control motor functions, skeletal muscle motor functions in your body, and the other is known responsible for sensation on the surface of your body. So let's go back to the first one. Which lobe of the brain is responsible for motion or motor control of skeletal muscle? Is it frontal or parietal? Yeah, it is the frontal lobe. Remember, the motor is in the front of your car. And sensory is posterior to that in the parietal lobe. Well, the spinal cord has pretty much that same arrangement. So where you see descending tracts, mostly are going to be in the anterior region of the spinal cord. Sensory tracts mostly will be in the posterior region of the spinal cord. And I'm not going to have you know exactly some locations in there, but I think that's probably a pretty good idea just to remember the different functions of the different lobes of the brain. All right, so here, so we have tracts in these regions. What this slide shows nicely is this vertebrae. Now, you could probably tell me what kind of vertebrae this is. Yeah, cervical. Bifurcated spinous process, right? Transverse foramina, all right? And then here is information that can either enter or leave the spinal cord. These are what we call roots to the central nervous system. I see there are two on the right, two on the left. And what about this one that I'm pointing to right now? How would we call this one? Would we want to call this one dorsal or ventral? Yeah, because there's the back, there's the spinous process, right? So that is the posterior, so we're going to call that the dorsal root. And then here is the ventral root. Now, the interesting thing about roots is that they carry information only in one direction. Not like the spinal cord where information can go up and down. A root only carries it into the spinal cord or out of the spinal cord. And the dorsal root is responsible for bringing information in. So what's the function of this dorsal root right here in terms of afferent or efferent? You would want to say afferent, right? All right, and so then that defines for you what the ventral root is. What it is efferent, right? Maybe it might be better to say motor and sensory to help you remember this because, let's see, in dorsal, you got a nice S in dorsal, you got a nice S in sensory. That kind of matches up, all right? And for over here, efferent and motor, there was a trick that I learned for that as well, but it's not coming to mind just right now. It's pretty silly, so I don't want to stop class to think about what it was. Maybe in lab I'll remember what it is. All right, so remember, roots are either motor or sensory, but not both. If it's both, it has a special name. If it's both, we call it a mixed nerve. All right, roots are not mixed. They're either sensory or motor. All right, but these roots do join together after they leave the vertebral column and become a nerve. So here is what we call a spinal nerve because it's leaving the vertebral column or it's leaving the spinal cord. And the spinal nerve right here does carry information, both afferent and efferent, right? Because both of these roots join to be right here. So spinal nerve is what we call, how would we want to designate spinal nerve? Efferent? Afferent or mixed, right? It's mixed, okay. All right, then I see a little bifurcation here. There's a little nerve that goes to the back, right? And then there's a bigger part of that nerve that goes anteriorly, and that's because you have, most of your body is what? Anterior to the vertebral column, so it requires more innervation. The other thing that I see on this particular slide, in the vertebral canal, it does demonstrate some layers, some connective tissue sheets. I see a lipid, I see an area that contains fat lipid, right? And then just deep to that is what we call the meninges. And the meninges has three different divisions to it. And here are the divisions, the pia, arachnoid, and dura. The dura is the most superficial. And So that's the dura. So this space right here that contains all of this lipid is called the epidural space, right? Epi on top of the dural part of the meninges. And so if we want to anesthetize or prevent impulses from traversing this region of the spinal cord, right, you can inject some anesthesia into this epidural space. Commonly you would call that an epidural. That's right. So you don't inject it into the spinal cord because you might lacerate something, right? Inject it into that space. And then these nerve impulses can't move through the spinal cord. All right, what is that thing that causes or is the results in a nerve impulse? What is that electrical event? Action potential. Fantastic, right? So that anesthesia will block that action potential from moving down these various tracts, right? And in particular, right, the sensory and probably motor tracts are affected as well. Okay. Here is a swelling. Here's a swelling, and it's a part of the dorsal root. I can sort of see it over here on the left, but I definitely can see it over here on the right. This is what we call the dorsal root, because it's part of the dorsal root ganglia. What do you know about a ganglion? Dorsal root ganglion. What do you know about a ganglion? Bunch of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, right? So it's going to be an area that is not myelinated because it doesn't contain axons, so it has cell bodies. And where would you find this? In the central nervous system or peripheral nervous system? Ganglia are in the peripheral nervous system, even though your book gets it confused a little bit every once in a while. So here's a dorsal root ganglia, and the dorsal root, is it sensory or is it motor? It's 100% sensory. And remember way back when we looked at different kinds of neurons, the kind of neuron that is sensory is what we call a pseudo-unipolar or a unipolar. And this is where all the cell bodies are of those pseudo-unipolar neurons. And hence, the parts that come down into the periphery, we call the peripheral process, right? And then the part of that cell that goes into the central nervous system, we call this the central process of those pseudo-unipolar neurons. Okay, what else do we want to know? Okay, here I can see the three layers of the meninges very nicely. Here's the dura mater, and dura just means really durable and tough. When we start to do some brain dissections in lab, you'll see that it is thin, but it's tougher than shoe leather. It's really hard to cut, and you can't rip it, right? Even though it's really, really thin. That's the dura mater that protects our central nervous system. Then, right under that is the arachnoid. Here's the arachnoid membrane, not quite so thick, not quite so tough. And then following every little crack and nook and cranny on the central nervous system, there's another membrane that we call the pia mater. All right, so the pia mater is very delicate, and it just adheres to every place on the brain, every place on the spinal cord. And there is a space between the pia mater and the arachnoid mater, and we call that the subarachnoid space. And it contains that fluid that we have been talking about, and that is cerebrospinal fluid. Cerebrospinal fluid in the subarachnoid space. All right, so let's look at some other things. Here we see a bunch of white matter in the spinal cord. This is almost like a transverse section, right? But it's, you kind of get it in a three-dimensional view a little bit. And these spaces have names. These are what we call columns or a funiculus. Column and funiculus is the same thing. And then, of course, here you see that dorsal root ganglia. So here would be the dorsal funiculus. And then out lateral would be the lateral funiculus. And then up over here would be the ventral funiculus. All right, so in the dorsal funiculus, these carry mostly sensory tracts. In the ventral funiculus, this carries mostly motor tracts. Not 100% all the time, but mostly. All right, so white matter is broken down into those different funiculi. And the gray matter that I see right here also has some areas, some designation areas. So these are what we call horns. Here is the dorsal horn. Here is the ventral horn. And then in between the two, pointing out to the side, these are the lateral horns of the spinal cord. And they all contain nerve cell bodies. Coming out of the spinal cord, I can also see these roots, right? The roots form from all the regions in between, right? And these are what we call rootlets. Rootlets converge to make a root. The dorsal and ventral root converge to make a nerve. Right? And just like roots, rootlets are, they are not mixed in function. They're purely motor or sensory, depending on what side of the spinal cord they are on. So all of these rootlets that I'm pointing to right now, right, that are on the ventral side, what's the function of all of these ventral roots right here? Yeah, motor. These are all motor because they go into the ventral root. Ventral root, remember, is 100% motor. The central canal that I see right here also contains cerebrospinal fluid. Coming down from the brain, it goes all the way down to the conus medullaris, right, and it runs out of spinal cord. Then it ends up in the subarachnoid space, and cerebrospinal fluid then goes back up to the brain through this subarachnoid space. And something then happens to it, which we'll talk about in just a little bit. All right, so spinal cord has a number of these different divisions that you got to be aware of, different ways we talk about it. Okay, I think I want to talk about the meninges next, because we have an orientation. How many membranes, I guess that's a good way of putting it, how many membranes does the meninges have? Yeah, there are three. Right, and I was going to ask you how many structures does the meninge have, but remember there is that subarachnoid space. I didn't want you to get confused with that. So here is a cross-section of a brain, not spinal cord. You could tell this is brain because the gray matter is superficial, white matter is deep. And here is a nice bone. This could be a parietal bone right here, nice flat bone of the skull, and we got some, right, the periosteum, and then we have some skin on top of that, right, because periosteum surrounds every exterior part of a bone. And then we have these different layers. What did we call that layer that's right on the surface of the brain, and it follows the brain or spinal cord exactly? That's the pia mater, not very strong, very delicate membrane. Then we have a space. Right, that's the subarachnoid space, which then tells you what's the membrane right above that. That is the arachnoid, right? Subarachnoid space contains cerebrospinal fluid. And then on top of that is the really tough membrane, the dura mater. And the dura mater has a couple different divisions. Here's the periosteal division that's up against the bone, right? And then here is the meningeal division of the dura mater. And that probably explains why the dura mater is so tough, because it's made up of a couple different layers. All right, so that's the meninges. Get the dura mater, superficial, arachnoid, right smack in the middle, a little bit deeper, and then the pia mater. And that subarachnoid space does have connective tissue fibers, right, that stabilize these membranes together. So you might be wondering, well, what happens to all that cerebrospinal fluid as it's returning from the spinal cord back up to the brain? The brain produces cerebrospinal fluid, and it's sort of like a circulatory system. So if the brain is making cerebrospinal fluid, it has to be returned to the vascular system. Otherwise, your head and spinal cord would just fill up with fluid, and there wouldn't be any room in there for brain. That would be terrible if that were to happen. I might have to sneeze for a second. No, it went away. Okay. Okay, so here's cerebrospinal fluid returning from all the external places in the brain and around the spinal cord. And here we have an arachnoid villus. Sometimes we may be called that a granulation. This is where the subarachnoid space pokes up through, right, all the way through the dura mater into this area that we call a sinus. And this is right smack middle plane, sagittal plane, so we call this the sagittal sinus, since it's right on the top of the head, the superior sagittal sinus. And what color does that look like to you? That looks blue. And that's because there's blood in there. Right? So a sinus can contain a whole bunch of stuff. One of the things that a sinus can contain is blood. And since it's blue, what could you tell me about that blood? Is it arterial blood or venous blood? It's venous blood. We haven't talked about that at all. If you didn't have any idea, that's okay. But arterial blood is red. Right, venous blood is blue, and it's a really good thing that this is a vein, because veins have very low pressure in them. So the cerebrospinal fluid can enter into the space pretty easily. If it was an artery, right, it would have to be colored red, and it would be really high pressure, hundreds of millimeters of mercury, or 120 millimeters of mercury, and then this fluid would actually be pushed right through this arachnoid villus into this subarachnoid space, and then, right, all that blood would force your brain out of your head, in a sense, right? It would really compress the brain. So this is a good thing that it is a vein, and you can tell it's a vein. The part of the dura mater that separates the right and left cerebral hemispheres, we call that the falx cerebri, that's in the longitudinal fissure only. And this is an exam figure, so that's why I spent some time going over it. All right, so let's look at the circulatory pattern. The circulatory pattern of the cerebral spinal fluid. All right, well, you see where it gets resorbed back into the circulatory system through this arachnoid villus or granulation. Here I see that superior sagittal sinus once again. Right, then blood is going to drain through the superior sagittal sinus and through a sigmoid sinus into a transverse and finally into the jugular vein back to the heart. It's not all shown on this particular slide. All right, but where does the cerebral spinal fluid come from? A particular structure. We talked about some cells that are responsible for making choroid plexus. So cerebral spinal fluid comes from choroid plexus. It's a special group of blood vessels we call capillaries. Capillaries are specialized for exchange. They like to leak fluid out. And then some nervous system cells that join together. And those would be the ependymal cells. Ependymal cells and capillaries join together in a couple locations and produce cerebrospinal fluid. So that cerebrospinal fluid is very similar to plasma that we have in our blood. It's pretty similar to it. So it contains glucose. Right, but the ionic composition might be a little bit different in terms of sodium and potassium, but it's the job of this choroid plexus to adjust all of that stuff. And the choroid plexus we find in some chambers inside the brain. So I see 1, 2, 3 main areas for choroid plexus. And probably I should show you these chambers in the brain first. So where are we going to find these chambers in the brain? Oh, here, I tell you what, since we were talking about this, all right, here's choroid plexus, here's a capillary, and you can see the wall of a capillary is very thin, right? This is an epithelium. How would you classify this epithelium that I'm pointing to right now that makes up this tube, this capillary? It is one layer, so it's simple, and the shape of these cells are squamous, right? And so remember, a simple squamous epithelium is designed for exchange because it's thin, so things can move across the membrane. So plasma can leave the capillary, and it's processed by these ependymal cells, and then they end up inside some cavities inside the brain that we call ventricles. All right, so here you see some ions that the CSF contains, sodium, chloride, magnesium, potassium as well. Oxygen, glucose, and various vitamins, those aren't ions, but nonetheless, you find those in cerebrospinal fluid. So where does all that stuff end up? I'll just take a stab at it here. That doesn't look right. That is not right. Okay, they are ventricles inside the brain. Ventricles. Okay. Here we have ventricles. So here is a nice anterior view of the cerebrum, right? I see the cerebellum, brainstem, maybe a little bit of spinal cord. And if we have look from the side, this is what it looks like, right? So here's the frontal lobe, occipital, cerebellum, spinal cord. And does anybody remember what this part of the brainstem is where I'm pointing right now? It's the most inferior part of the brain, that is the medulla oblongata, and then right on top of that is the pons, right? And then we got the temporal lobe here, frontal, parietal, and occipital lobes. All right, so here, this blue represents some spaces inside the brain. And there's a fluid inside these spaces. What do we call that fluid once again? Yeah, cerebrospinal fluid. Where does it come from? The choroid plexus that are in these ventricles. So you're going to remember a ventricle is a chamber. There are ventricles or chambers inside the heart. Here are ventricles or chambers inside the brain, but their function is a little bit different, well, a lot different, because the ventricles in the brain don't pump blood like the ventricles in the heart. Okay. Here are some ventricles that are way off midline. Here's midline, right? Here's a mid-sagittal plane going through the brain. So what do we call something that is either to the right or left of this median plane or mid-sagittal plane? Could they? Yeah, parasagittal. I like parasagittal. That's great, right? But I wasn't quite thinking that sophisticated. Okay. Would these things be medial or lateral to this mid-sagittal plane? Lateral, right? So we call these the lateral ventricles. They used to be called number 1 and 2. Got a little bit complicated. Actually, there's more than two pieces to them. So all of this stuff right here, we're just going to call lateral ventricles. And it has cerebrospinal fluid, right? So I see lateral ventricles here, and you can see the three pieces to it, like the inferior, posterior, anterior horn. I'm not so sure that's probably not in your lab manual that you have to know all these different divisions, but you do have to know that these are the lateral ventricles that are off midline. And they produce cerebrospinal fluid that flows through this connection into the third ventricle. The third ventricle is on the inside of the thalamus and hypothalamus. It's right between the lobes of the thalamus and hypothalamus. The thalamus and hypothalamus aren't shown on this slide, but once you look at a nice sagittal section, you'll be able to see where this third ventricle is. And here is a hole that connects the two. Right, and we call that the interventricular foramen, because these are all ventricles, interventricular foramen. And what's the function of a foramen in one word? Again, you learn from bones. It's a passageway. And in this particular case, it's a passageway for what? Cerebrospinal fluid, right? So cerebrospinal fluid will flow from the lateral ventricle into the third. Right. So here is the third ventricle on that nice anterior view, and then cerebrospinal fluid will flow into the fourth ventricle, which is more at the level between the pons and the medulla. And here is that connection. We don't call it a foramen because it's really long, right? And unlike this interventricular foramen here, this is what we call the cerebral aqueduct. We don't even call it a canal. Aqueduct, because it contains that CSF. Sometimes we call it the canal of Sylvius, right? But cerebral aqueduct is really good. And then cerebrospinal fluid flows into that central canal. What part of your nervous system has that central canal? Yeah, we just talked about it, but since you haven't studied it, it might be hard to picture or remember. But it is the spinal cord, right? So CSF flows all the way down to the conus medullaris, and then it's returned to the brain via the subarachnoid space. And then it gets resorbed up there by that superior sagittal sinus. All right, so these are ventricles inside the brain. So, and their cerebrospinal fluid is all the way around the outside of the brain. So if we were to weigh you with a scale, right, if we were to weigh you right now up here by the lecture stand and weigh you in a pool when you go swimming, where would you be heavier, or would you weigh the same? Okay, you wouldn't weigh the same because that water would kind of support you because you are buoyant, right? And so that cerebrospinal fluid helps support the brain. It helps float the brain in the cranial space because this is pretty delicate tissue, right? It might actually compress itself if it wasn't floating in all of that fluid, right? Because the brain doesn't have any bones. It just has those membranes around it and fluid. The other thing that this cerebrospinal fluid does besides nourishing the brain itself, it helps distribute impacts or trauma throughout the brain, right? And physiologists and engineers have realized that. And so now when people design helmets, right, to absorb impacts, helmets now include chambers that contain air or fluid in them, right? Football players wear these fluid-filled chambers. And that helps absorb shock in one area, distribute it all the way around the brain so that one particular area doesn't receive the full brunt of that force. So that's another function that these ventricles perform. All right, so we got lateral, third, fourth. What connects the fourth and the third ventricle? It's going to be the cerebral aqueduct. That's part of the midbrain. And So let's maybe take a look and see where that one nice figure was. 14, if I remember correctly. Here it is. Nice exam figure that's coming up for you. All right, so we talked about the hemispheres of the cerebrum. So we're probably looking at the right cerebral hemisphere. Then there are some commissural tracts that go from right to left through the corpus callosum, right? I can see the corpus callosum right here. Here's the thalamus and the hypothalamus, and there's a space right smack in the middle between the lobes of the thalamus and the hypothalamus. This is the ventricle. What ventricle is this? This is the third ventricle, indeed the third ventricle. Here is that cerebral aqueduct bringing CSF to the fourth ventricle, and then here is that central canal. All right, so I think you're beginning to understand some of this brain, what it looks like a little bit now. Okay, you'll be even more familiar by the time we get to it in lab. Here is a curtain. It comes down from a structure we call the fornix all the way up to the corpus callosum. It's a pretty delicate structure. And if we were to move through this thing that we call the septum pellucidum, what's a septum again? Yeah, it's a little curtain or wall that separates out two chambers like your nasal septum, right? So here's one in the brain, the septum pellucidum. It separates the lateral ventricles from each other. And so if we were to go through the septum pellucidum, we would end up in a lateral ventricle right smack on the other side. And then here's that interventricular foramen that's connecting the lateral ventricles with the third ventricle. All right, so I promise you we're going to look at the flow pattern. Lateral ventricles contain choroid plexus. The roof of the third ventricle contains choroid plexus. And even this part of this ventricle contains choroid plexus. And what is this ventricle down here? Could you name this one? Yeah, that's the fourth ventricle. Right? So lateral, third, fourth, all have choroid plexus producing cerebral spinal fluid. All right, so that flow pattern is, you're looking at it right here. That's nice. All right, so can you see the choroid plexus in the lateral, in the third, and in the fourth? And then that cerebrospinal fluid can leave the fourth ventricle through some openings that we call apertures into the subarachnoid space, or that CSF can go all the way down through the central canal to the tip of the spinal cord and exit, and then it makes its way back up to the top of the brain via the subarachnoid space, and that fluid then gets put back into the circulatory system because that's where all this fluid came from initially, right? It was from a capillary. It's put back into the vascular system, and that's important so that we don't dehydrate. That's also important because if that fluid wasn't returned to the vascular system, it would compress the brain, right, or compress the spinal cord, and then, of course, the brain and spinal cord couldn't function the way it should be functioning. Okay, we talked about meninges, cerebral spinal fluid, through the flow, all that stuff. I think we talked about reflexes already, but a reflex is some information that's really important, right? And so it's okay if we go over it again. Oh, we didn't talk about tracts just yet. Okay. Ah, before we talk about reflexes, I want to go back to cerebrospinal fluid. Okay, if there's blockage of the cerebral aqueduct or blockage of this interventricular foramen, cerebrospinal fluid is going to back up or not be released from these various chambers. And the lateral ventricles can swell up if CSF can't leave. And that happens in some people, and it compresses their brain. Here is an example of that condition that we call hydrocephalus. All right, so here is a newborn, and the ventricles in this person's brain have expanded because the interventricular foramen or the aqueduct of Sylvius is blocked and that CSF has no place to go. And I'm sure this person didn't live very long because this is really a terrible condition, can't really be treated. But it can be treated, right, if that condition is diagnosed early enough, right, with ultrasound or other kind of imaging techniques, and actually surgery on that fetus can be done in utero to open up some of these restrictions, or actually place a shunt, place a little tube that goes from a ventricle into the subarachnoid space, and that reduces the swelling of the brain, and the brain then can develop normally. That's amazing that that kind of surgery, basically it's some kind of neurosurgery that can be done on a person before they're born even, right? So that the hydrocephalus condition, right, can be alleviated and prevented. All right, so that finishes up cerebral spinal fluid. Reflex arc. All right, what does a reflex always start with? A stimulus. And we don't talk about it in this particular chapter, but we have before. I think you might remember some figures in your mind. Okay, so reflex arc always starts with a stimulus. Is it on your list? Right here. Reflex arc. You see stimulus. Okay, I see sensory receptors being one. The first item right here. So what should you do? Definitely modify your notes. Right? Because a reflex always has to start with a stimulus, or a response loop always has to start with a stimulus. And your body can, or you can appreciate a stimulus if you have a receptor for it. Right? If it's a damaging stimulus, you need a pain receptor. If it's light, you need a photoreceptor. Right? Then that information has to get into the brain via sensory neuron. What's another name for a sensory neuron? Afferent. Yeah, afferent neuron. Then through the right past the dorsal root ganglia, through the dorsal root into the spinal cord, where it's going to share some information with a neuron that's completely within the central nervous system. That's what we call an association neuron. And also that association neuron becomes a part of this reflex that we call the integration center, that can make a decision on what to do with that information. Maybe push away from some hot object. Right, so the brain decides what to do, or spinal cord decides what to do. How does your periphery get that information? What kind of neuron? Yeah, efferent, right? Motor neuron. And how do motor neurons leave the spinal cord? What root? Ventral root, right? And then that becomes the motor neuron, goes to an effector organ, and say if we're talking about motion of your body, that would be skeletal muscle. I was going to ask you something silly, right? I was going to ask you what the effector organ for skeletal muscle is, but it is an effector organ. But nonetheless, this effector organ, skeletal muscle, is always going to produce something, a response. That's right. So a reflex starts with a stimulus, ends in a response. So make sure that you fill in your notes. And what kind of item always produces a response? What produces a response? Probably said it, but I didn't quite hear. It's always going to be an effector organ, right? Effector organ, and an effector organ gets its information from an effector neuron or motor neuron. All right, and the effector organ for your voluntary nervous system is skeletal muscle, right? Okay, we're going to look at some other effector organs of the autonomic nervous system in a little bit. Okay, some tracts. I promise you that we're going to look at some tracts. Okay, here are some examples. Spinal thalamic tract. So it starts in the spine, goes to the thalamus. Okay, so is this an efferent or an afferent tract? Spinal thalamic. It goes from spinal cord to brain. It's ascending. How should you think of an ascending tract? Okay, it is sensory. Can you see that it's ascending, right? Spinal cord to thalamus. Thalamus is way up in the brain. Spinal cord is way down below it. Okay. Let me see if I can find a spinal thalamic tract someplace. Spinal cerebellar. Spinal thalamic tract. Okay. Here we see a nice spinal thalamic tract. And you can see that this is responsible for sensation, temperature, and pain sensation. So here we have some receptors maybe on the bottom of your foot, and it gets burned. So there are temperature receptors in the dermis. And then that information goes into the spinal cord, right? Goes into the central nervous system. What kind of neuron is involved? What kind of neuron is sensory by shape? What kind of shape of a neuron? Is the pseudo-unipolar neuron? Okay, and I'm going to lose my cursor, but I have to zoom in because it's just way too small to see otherwise. All right, I see a nice foot right here with receptors. And does this look like a pseudo unipolar neuron right here? Here's the peripheral process, here's the central process, and we know this to be always a sensory neuron. And then here's a ganglia filled with, what do we see right there? Yeah, the nerve cell bodies of that particular pseudo-unipolar neuron. But there's not just one, right? There's thousands of these bringing information into the central nervous system via what root into the spinal cord? The dorsal root, right? Because here's the dorsal root ganglia. All right, so that's the first neuron. Now, that neuron doesn't take information all the way to the brain. It synapses right here in this this posterior horn. And again, I can see nerve cell bodies, right? That's why this is gray matter. And this neuron then takes information, crosses over. So what kind of pathway is this gray matter between the right and left sides of the spinal cord?
Commissure.
Yeah, it's a commissure. So we call this the gray commissure. And it crosses over, and then it starts to ascend. All right, and I want to zoom back out, zoom out. All right, so I see these arrows ascending. So clearly, this is a sensory tract or an afferent tract, and it goes, let's change it like this, it goes all the way through the medulla. Here we see the medulla passes through the pons, through the midbrain, right, all one neuron, and there it ends in this structure right here, which is a relay center, right? It's going to end, and it's going to pass information on to another neuron, which takes it to the cerebral cortex. All right, so does anybody remember what this gray matter is called right here? That is the thalamus. Yeah, here's corpus callosum is here, right and left information. Thalamus is right below it, and that's what we saw in the sagittal section. And so there are how many neurons necessary to bring information from some surface receptor on your body to the cortex of your cerebrum? How many did you see? Here's one. Right, sensory neuron, and then here is two. This is an association neuron making this nice afferent tract. It stops at the thalamus, and then here is the third order neuron. Right, so it takes three to get through there. All right, here's that internal capsule once again for motor tracts, right between the thalamus and these basal nuclei. All right, so here is spinal thalamic tract. This is an example of what kind of tract? Afferent or efferent?
Afferent,
yeah, sensory tract. Okay, I also want you to have a sense of a cortical spinal tract. Cortical spinal. So what kind of tract is this, efferent or afferent? Starts in the cerebral cortex, goes to the spinal cord. So that's a motor tract. So let's see if we can find something that looks like a cortical spinal tract. Okay, here I see the ventral cortical spinal tract. So since it's motor, where do these signals always originate from? I see skeletal muscle right here. Okay, they originate from the motor areas in your brain. What lobe is motor? Frontal or parietal? Frontal, yeah. So here is that primary motor cortex, which is what, the precentral gyrus, which is in the frontal lobe. And, let's zoom into this region right here. Right. Nice. So where do you see these dots? These dots represent nerve cell bodies, right? And where do you find them? What kind of matter of the brain? Gray matter. Does that make sense to you? Should that be gray matter? Yeah, because nerve cell bodies are never myelinated, right? So here you have all these nerve cell bodies. And then here's the axon from that nerve cell body coming down through, what is this white matter right here between the thalamus and basal nuclei? This is what we call the internal capsule. And would you guess that this internal capsule should look white? Yeah, because why? You have myelinated axons, not cell bodies and dendrites here. So here we have that axon moving down through. Okay. All the way down into the medulla, passes the pons and in the medulla, and look what can happen sometimes. It can cross over to the other side of the spinal cord. We call that decussation. When something switches over, it decussates over, And this decussation produces a bunch of triangles pretty much right on the surface of the medulla. And last time, I called those the pyramids. Right? That, and the pyramids, the function of these pyramids is that's where signals cross from one side of the central nervous system to the other. We call that decussation. So here is that lateral cortical spinal tract. And it goes all the way down, okay, to wherever it's going to leave the vertebral column or spinal cord. All right, so here is the end of that first neuron. It synapses on an association or interneuron, and that stimulates a neuron. And here's an axon that leaves the spinal cord. What root does it have to go through? The ventral root, and it goes all the way to this skeletal muscle. And you should consider this, what is this skeletal muscle going to produce? A response. So what's a nice general way that you want to think of the skeletal muscle? Is an effector organ for the voluntary nervous system, right? Starting, it originated in the parietal lobe, right? The postcentral gyrus. Okay, so those are some tracts, right? So damage to this part of the spinal cord, right, would damage this motor tract. There would be a motor deficit in somebody. Okay, well, that takes me to one last item, and that is the homuncular diagram, the little homunculus. And let's take a look here first, just to review some things. So I see nice cerebellum, occipital lobe, temporal, right, parietal lobe, frontal lobe. Here's that central sulcus. What does that central sulcus separate? That's a line of separation between the frontal lobe, right, and the parietal lobe. And I can see the temporal lobe very nice. Here you can see some of those functional areas in the brain that I was talking about, Wernicke's area, right? Important for understanding language. Here is Broca's area. Where's Broca's area? Should be here. Should be right here. Ah, Broca's area right there. That is that's for speech, but it's for speaking, right? For speaking. That's the motor part of speech. Okay, and it goes over some other things like vision and hearing, etc., etc. Well, what I want to pay attention to is this central sulcus. Remember, anterior to that is the frontal lobe. Here is that gyrus, that first gyrus in the frontal lobe. You got to be able to name this gyrus. What's the name of this gyrus? This is the precentral gyrus. Precentral meaning right in front of the central sulcus. Is it labeled on this slide? Rats, it's not. Good question. You couldn't just read the slide. So here's the precentral gyrus, which means that this one here is the postcentral gyrus. Right? So let's stay with the postcentral gyrus. What's the function of this postcentral gyrus? Is it motor or sensory? It's got to be sensory. Remember, motor's in the front. And is it labeled? Yes. Primary somatosensory cortex. And the somato part means on the surface of your body. Right? So skin sensation. And the precentral gyrus is where impulses originate to control or stimulate skeletal muscle, right? Because that's motor. All right, I said once before that this gyrus, or an area in a gyrus, is responsible for one area in your body, right? And you're going to see on the next slide that these areas are continuous with each other, right? So areas on your digits or fingers are going to be next to areas that are on your wrist or your hand, right? So the areas that are on your hand are next to areas that are on your wrist. The areas that for wrist are next to areas that are on your forearm, right? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So let's take a look at, so actually if you think about the functional areas, what does it look like? Well, I saw fingers, hand, wrist, arm, forearm, arm. What does that remind you of? That reminds you of like somebody's body. Right, so somebody actually drew that out. Okay, so here's somebody's body. We call this a homunculus. All right, so here is the surface of the cortex. Right, and this is for motor, and the colors probably match up really nice. So this is what, the precentral or postcentral motor? Precentral. All right, so if we stimulate this part of the precentral gyrus, what's going to happen? You're going to wiggle your toes, right? Because that's what these neurons are responsible for. Right? And if you stimulate this area here with electrical current or something, what's going to happen? Yeah, you're going to like step up on your tiptoes. Right? And then here are some areas for your trunk. Right? And then all of these areas right here, this is a large area. Right? So if we stimulate someplace over here, what's going to happen? Yeah, your hand is going to move. Your fingers are going to move. Now, you have a lot of dexterity, a lot of fine motor control in this area, or that part of your body, your hand, and so it requires a large part of the surface area of the cerebral cortex to control that very important part of your body. Right? And so there is another region in your body that requires a lot of processing power to control because you have very fine control of muscles. They're not postural muscles. You have really small motor units, and that is your face. All right, so if we were to stimulate this area right here, what would happen? He would blink, right? Or if we stimulate this area right here, his mouth might open, okay, for instance. So this is all what? This is all motor. What would happen if we were to move this area right here? He might kick, or she might kick, right? It's going to move somebody's leg. It might flex at the hip or something like that, okay? And then here is for tongue and swallowing. So that's a primary motor cortex. So here is anterior. I see the two cerebral hemispheres. Here's posterior. So the central sulcus is right there on that plane. And does that look like a nice red color to you? Indeed it is. All right, so this would control the left side of your body, and over here would control the right side of your body, right, in terms of somatic motor control. All right, where would we look for sensory perception in the cerebral cortex? It would be the post-central gyrus. So here's an example of the post-central gyrus. And notice, you see there is really nice comparison between the motor cortex and the sensory cortex. Right? It's the same person, same areas. Right? So if we stimulate this area right here, what's going to be the sensation? Okay, like right here, I was actually thinking right here. You would like be tickling somebody under their arm, okay? That would be, so it would be for sensation, all right? And if we take a pin, or if we stimulate this area right here, what's going to happen? They're going to have a sensation on their foot, right? Okay, so the postcentral gyrus is for sensation, is responsible for sensation on the surface of your body. The precentral gyrus is for controlling skeletal muscle. Right, somatic skeletal muscle, because skeletal muscle is not deep inside body cavities, right? It's superficial. Okay, so there's a little homuncular diagram. Well, did I pass the science sheet around? Indeed, I did. Okay, well, we didn't get into peripheral nervous system, so I don't know what we're going to do. But at least we're done with central nervous system. Please sign the science sheet. Here come the lights.